organized by the Society's Clachan Project. Our guest speaker tonight is Mr. Ian Montgomery, archivist at the Public Records Office in Belfast. Over the year, Ian has been a good friend of the Society. He has spoken on several occasions and written several articles for our Glynn's Journal, our yearly publication. So without further ado, can I introduce and welcome on the Society's behalf and your behalf, Mr. Ian Montgomery.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that warm welcome, and my apologies for the delay and start. It always takes longer than I remember getting back to the Glens. It's much further from Larne than I remember, but I'm sure you all like it that way. Right, and it's a great pleasure to be back in the Glens, and it's particularly appropriate to be in the Londonderry Arms, which is named in honour of, and of a lady who we'll be talking about later on, Frances Anne, Marchioness of Londonderry, who was instrumental in having the inn built here. So that's particularly nice to be here. I've been following the Clachan's project with some interest over the last few years, and I've been very impressed with the work that's been done, and have seen the website. The purpose of tonight's talk is to look at ways of going beyond the record which you've been using in the Clachan's project to date. I know you've concentrated on the valuation record, the ordnance survey and the census, all excellent records, very detailed information, but I've been urging various people that I've talked to about it to go beyond those and to look at the estate papers to try and get more depth into the study. We'll be focusing tonight on the estate papers of the Earls of Antrim, who were the largest landlord in the North Antrim area. Now, they didn't, or by the end of the 19th century, they certainly didn't own all of North Antrim. There are many other landlords, many of whose papers are also in the Public Record Office, the Boyds, Michael Downey's, Higgins and Snap and various other archives, the McCartney's as well. So what I've got to say, while focusing on the Glens of Antrim, or on the Earls of Antrim, will be useful if you want to look at some of those other landlords as well. And when I looked down the list of Clachans on the website, quite a few of them are in lands which weren't actually owned or controlled by the Earls of Antrim in the 19th century. They were owned by other landlords. But there are certainly quite a few of the Clachans were on the Earls of Antrim's land. I'm not going to say very much about the whole background to landlordism and the landed estates. We probably all know the importance of the big landowners in Ireland from the 17th century right through until the end of the 19th century. Excuse me. You had a number of very, very large landowners, like the Cunninghams in the south of Ireland with 157,000 acres, the Downshires and 115,000 acres. Big institutional owners like the Church of Ireland, which owned vast estates, Trinity College Dublin. So you had these huge estates all over Ireland. Now, not all land, of course, was owned by large landowners, but quite a large proportion of it was. And their archives are extremely important for the study of local history in Ireland, both because of what they tell us about landlords and tenant relationships, and also because they replace or stand in the place of a lot of archives which were destroyed in 1922. When the Public Record Office was set up in 1922, the first Deputy Keeper, David Chart, his main objective was to replace those records that had been damaged in the Four Courts fire. And one of the main sources that he looked to do that was the records of the big landowners. And he used the influence of the first governor in Northern Ireland, the Duke of Abercorn, to approach all the big landed estates and start encouraging them to deposit their archives, which they have done. And the Earls of Antrim have been one of the landlords who have done that. There's my name turning up. There you go. The Earls of Antrim, when their day, were one of the very, very big landowners in Ireland. That is what the estate looked like in 1600. It was the four baronies, Kilconway, Dunluce, Kerry, and Glenarm, plus Rathlin Island. That was the core of the estate, plus a little bit of land here. They actually lost the area around Coleraine. They did a deal to give that to London companies, But that was the core of the estate. Now, over the years, that declined in size, and we'll be looking at why that happened. But they still remain an important landowner, and even in areas where they were to sell off or lose their land, they still remained important as the head landowner. For instance, they claimed mineral rights over those four baronies, even after they'd sold off land, and this was one consequence of that was quite a lot of legal action later on the 19th century, when you had the mini-industrial revolution in the Glens of Antrim. You had the mining, and suddenly people come in with mining rights, and you see the Earl of Antrim coming out of the woodwork, as it were, to start claiming the rights in those areas. The importance of the archive sort of lasts up until the end of the 19th century, until the land starts passing across to the tenants, although you know the family estate still owns head rents and things like that, so it still continues to be of some importance through the 20th century, and you know, the Earls of Antrim have been important figures in the local area as well. Right, I'm going to look at the estate archive. And as I say, what I'm saying here to a certain extent applies to any large landed estate archive. I always divide the landed estate papers and archives into two sorts. There's those that emanate from the big house, and there's those that emanate from the estate office. Obviously, that's the big house, that's Glenarm Castle. So there are the family papers and the political papers about the Earls of Antrim and what they did. But there's also the estate office as well, and that is also very important, and that's what we're actually going to be focusing on tonight. Many of the archives in Prony, some of them, in some cases, the big house side of it is more important than the estate office. For instance, you have archives like people like Lord Castlereagh, Lord Dufferin, very important international political figures. And those archives, it's the big house side of it that people usually focus on, although they do have they do have estate papers as well. But with the Antrim papers, the focus has always been on the estate office papers, and I think anyway, I'm probably prejudiced on the subject, it is one of the best estate office archives that exists in the Public Record Office. A landed estate can really be thought of as a business. And in many ways, the archive is very like a business archive. It was how the family drew their income from the estate, and the trick was to get money out of that. Believe it or not, being given a large whack of land by the king did not necessarily make you rich. You had to find a way of getting some money. You had to get people to give you money. So obviously the way to do it is to lease the land to people, but you had to get tenants, you had to make sure they were prepared to pay. There are other things you could exploit, which we'll be looking at later, to bring money in, but it is a business and you have to find ways of getting some return out of that land. So the archive records the transactions or interactions between, usually between a landlord and the tenants, people leasing land, but also people who are running businesses on the land or have franchises for things like fisheries and things like that. Right, I'm going to briefly run through the history of the family and the estate. It's important you know this, so you understand who you're dealing with, how the estate broke up, what records are going to be there. I'm not going to go through the whole history of the McDonald's, you'll be glad to hear. That's a subject for another night and not by me. And I'm going, as far as the archive is concerned, it all starts in 1600 with the first man who became the first Earl of Antrim, who made the transition from being a Gaelic chief and chieftain into an ascendancy landowner. And again, that's a complicated story how he did that. The MacDonalds, as you know, had been in North Antrim since the 14th century. They had been involved in a power struggle with the O'Neills during that period. They were still very much involved with the West of Scotland and politics in the West of Scotland. With the accession of James I, they were in a very strong position because they had good, James the First Earl had very good relations with King James VI of Scotland. He became James I of England. And he used that relationship in order to secure for himself this estate, 333,000 acres, 520 square miles, those four baronies. Now, he already owned that, but he made sure that the king granted him a charter or a patent, giving them that land and secured his position. This was the era of the plantation of Ulster. Randall was a Catholic and from a Gaelic background, but he was prepared to cooperate with the plantation and with the crown, and that is why he survived. You've all heard of the flight of the Earls, where O'Neill and O'Donnell Maguire all left Ireland in 1609 and cleared away the plantation. Randall didn't go. Randall the First Earl didn't go, and I think he was just smarter than the O'Neills at that. He wasn't panicked into leaving. He stuck to his ground. He had a good contacts at court with James I, and he survived. His son Randall, who was the second Earl, he needed to make a figure at court. He needed to secure his political influence in England at court, for which he needed money. So he had to raise a large sums of money on the estate, which we'll be seeing briefly how he did that later. And he had to spend large sums of money. The gamble was to spend these large sums of money in London and acquire a rich wife. Now, he did acquire a rich wife, but unfortunately he didn't look at the fine print on the marriage contract and he didn't get to keep the money. He also served Charles I throughout the Civil War period. More or less faithfully, Jane Almayer's book, Biography of him, makes interesting reading. Sometimes it's difficult to work out exactly whose side he was on. I think he was generally on Randall's side. He more or less usually on the side of Charles I, though he did survive the Cromwellian period. He got very little thanks for his service. He ran up very large debts, and he just about got his lands back in the Restoration 1660, only just, and with a bit of a fight. So he left a big burden of debt, which remained on the estate almost for the next 200 years. You can see the results of that big burden of debts which he got into there. Alexander, the third Earl, his brother, succeeded him briefly. He made another bad decision to support James II against William III. He was at the Siege of Derry on the wrong side of the walls. He did, though, survive. He was in Limerick, or near to Limerick, when the Treaty of Limerick was signed, so he was pardoned. And again, the Antrims escaped again. They managed to keep their land, although, again, it was a fairly close-run thing in the case of the third Earl. On through the next generations, the fourth Earl, who died young, didn't do much, but he married a daughter of Viscount Mazarin. That's the Clotworthies, who had established themselves in the south of County Antrim, round Randallstown and the town of Antrim. They were the major Protestant plantation landowners in that part of Antrim. By marrying into that family, they made an important political alliance and secured their future. And the alliance between the Mazarin and Antrim interests remains important throughout the 18th century. Major consequence of that is that the children of the fourth Earl were brought up as Protestants. And when Alexander came of age in 1734, I think it was, he took the oaths and declared himself to be a Protestant. And from there on, the family then was secured as part of the Protestant landed ascendancy. Not everybody believed he was sincere about all this, by the way, but he did it anyway, and actually secured the land. At this stage, there was a survey done in 1734 when he came of age, and the estate was down to 152,000 acres. A mere pittance. What had happened to the rest of the land in between is not altogether clear. Some of it had been sold off by the second Earl to raise money, which he could spend over in London. Sold off in the forms of what were called fee farm grants, which basically you give a lease forever of an area of land at a very small annual rent, with a big payment up front, what's called a fine, which is paid up front, which is what the second Earl wanted. He wanted cash in his hand. It was a process which happens a lot in Irish history, and it's known as finding down the rents. You take a big entrance payment for in return for a very small rent. And the second Earl had done this to quite a large extent, so that land then had moved out of the control of the family. Ballycastle, for instance, moves out of the control of the family by a fee farm grant period. So down 152,000 acres. There's also a lot of controversy. They had a long period where you had a child as the Earl when the estate's been looked after by trustees. Lots of things go on when you have trustees there, and a lot of lands. They talked at this period quite a lot about hidden lands, which basically meant that land had just disappeared, in the sense that the Earl didn't know whether he owned it or not. The people who lived in it were pretty sure that he didn't own it, and he couldn't really prove things one way or the other. So the estate is being whittled down here, though it's still fairly substantial. Now, the interesting thing about the 18th century Earls, with all this land, they still didn't have two gold pieces to rub together. There was still always very little correspondence remains from this period, but in it they're always pleading poverty. Didn't stop them rebuilding Glenarm Castle and doing things like that, but they did seem to be short of cash a lot of the time. They didn't become major political figures this period. They did keep a house in London, but they can't be said to have been major political figures, wheelers and dealers. In fact, when the fifth Earl died, one account is that his creditors seized his body and wouldn't allow it to be buried until his son had actually paid off some of the debts, and they got to that stage. The sixth Earl, Randall, no male heir, and it wasn't for the want of trying. He had three wives, and he had at least two illegitimate children, two illegitimate sons, but he had no legitimate male heir. He only had daughters in legitimate marriages. That meant, and there was no really close relatives, that meant that the estate would then, in theory, should have, and the title should have passed out of the family. He did a fairly unusual thing, which is more or less unprecedented, as far as I know, in Ireland. He arranged for the title to pass to his daughters. And to do that, he had to get a new patent issued of earldom. And it meant his daughters became the Earls of Antrim. They used to refer to as countesses in their own right. He did that and put a lot of trouble, went to a lot of trouble to get that done. He didn't, unfortunately, take as much trouble to work out where the land was going to go. General consequence is the land goes with the title. But in fact, the land was divided up between the three daughters, one of whom died fairly soon after the sixth Earl died, so there's really only two daughters to consider. This caused a huge legal row, and without going into the details, from Randall dying in 1791, the legal cases rumbled on and weren't really settled till about 1830s. It just went on and on and on. There was two daughters, I say. There's a third daughter called Letitia, I think, who died quite young. But the two main daughters were about Anne Catherine and Charlotte. Anne Catherine, that's her picture there, she married a guy called Harry Vane Tempest, who was a penniless, bad-tempered, and fairly unpleasant man, as far as we can see. When I say he was penniless, he wasn't sure to be a good catch. He owned thousands of acres of empty moorland in Durham. What nobody knew at the time was that it was sitting on top of one of the largest coal fields in Western Europe. So it wasn't actually a bad marriage in the long run, though it looked like one at the time. So she married Harry Vane Tempest, and she had one daughter, Frances Anne, who we'll hear much more about later. Anne Catherine, as it happened, after Harry Vane Tempest died, she married again and scandalised everybody by marrying a guy called Edmund Phelps, who was the secretary to one of her friends, man of no family or title, much younger than her, caused a major scandal, and he took the name of Edmund MacDonald Esquire. He actually turned out to be quite a good thing in many ways, because he dragged Anne Catherine back to Ireland, got her to live in Glenarm, and more or less rescued what was remains of her estate by managing it much more efficiently. But the marriage scandalised everybody, including Anne Catherine's daughter, Frances Anne. He was completely affronted by the whole thing. The other daughter, Anne Catherine's sister Charlotte, when Anne Catherine eventually died, 34, she briefly inherited the title and became a countess herself. She had married Lord Carr, who was the younger son of a Scottish nobleman. Again, he didn't have very much money. He was a naval officer, a career officer, not particularly rich. But their children, their son Hugh, inherited the title of Earl of Antrim eventually. And that is how the title then, the current Earls of Antrim's, descend from that guy Hugh. Said here's the ninth Earl, but because Randall got a new patent, they started the counting again, so he is actually, another way of looking at it is he's the fourth Earl. This causes massive confusion, and I wouldn't worry about it. I think the current Earls are going back to the old counting. So the estate divides. You have the Earls of Antrim estate, based in Glenorm, the sense that that was where they lived, their house, round about 34,000 acres by the middle of the 19th century. Then you have Vane Tempest, that is Frances Anne, who married the third Marquess of Londonderry and became the Marchioness of Londonderry, and she has an estate of about 13,000 acres based in Garantar. She actually bought land as well as inheriting that part of the estate. She actually bought more land, bought land around Napping, not far from here. So that's how the estate divides up. But one important part, although there was two different estates, there was only one archive. When Frances Anne died, her part of the estate was inherited by one of her grandchildren called Lord Herbert Vane Tempest, who wasn't particularly interested in it. And Garantar, which she had built, as you probably know, as a summer home, was eventually leased off or sold off to be a hotel before it became a school. The archive, the estate archive of the Garantar estate, was kept in Garantar. Towards the end of the 19th century, previous to that, they'd had different agents from the Earls of Antrim, quite deliberately, because they didn't want anything to do with the Earls of Antrim. But eventually, the agent for the Earl of Antrim was a guy called Alex MacDonald, took over the agency for the Vane Tempest estate as well. And when Garantar was going to be sold, he removed the archive and put it into the estate office at Glenorm. So that reunited the archives. So the archives for both parts of the estate went into the Glenorm archive and from there into Pruney, which is an important part. And just as well he did it, because there was a serious fire in Garantar about 1914. So if it stayed there in Garantar, it would probably have been destroyed. So to say, one archive, although there's actually two estates. Right. So what is in this archive? I'm going to run through briefly the types of records that you'll get in the archive. As I say, this is focused on the Earl of Antrim's archive, but in general terms it applies to any landed estate archive. And I've grouped together the different types of paper roughly, trying to explain how they fit together. The first section is what I've called documents relating to the ownership of the estate. Those are the patents and title deeds, the deeds by which the Crown granted the estate to the Antrim family, other deeds to do with the various legal disputes and the division of the estate. Fairly dry stuff, although interesting to see how the property did descend and who went to. Legal papers are included in here, huge amount of legal papers in the Antrim estate, were a very litigious family. Well, quite a lot of the Irish aristocracy was very litigious. When they stopped fighting duels, they took to fighting court cases with each other. The legal papers can actually be quite interesting. There's some very amusing stuff in the estate papers. The various rows the Earls had about rights of way across Glenorm Park, where they had this huge feud with the local vicar about whether or not he could drive across the park on a Sunday. The papers about the Giant's Causeway case are in there as well, when they fought about the ownership of the Giant's Causeway and rights there. So they're actually quite interesting. But wills and testamentary papers, obviously for the family, the wills are quite important. And encumbered and landed estates court papers, another not very exciting source, though if you have the time and patience, can be quite rewarding. They deal with the selling off of the estate to the tenants, and you get to see how that happened. And just by way of an example, I just pulled up one of the many very interesting pieces of parchment which comes under this title. That happens to be an agreement between Alexander, the third Earl of Antrim, and Rose, who was the widow of the second Earl, about various bits of her property. Rose was an O'Neill, and the second wife of the second Earl. And as with his first wife, he married a woman with property and didn't get the property. The O'Neills made sure that it didn't go to the McDonald's and it went back to Rose. He never seemed to read the fine print in marriage settlements very well. It's up there. It's unusual in that to have a signature of a woman on a legal deed of this period. That's Rose Antrim. Very strong-minded lady, quite an interesting lady, who had paid a very important role in the affairs of the second Earl, and indeed was largely responsible for, as many people claim, from getting his estates back after 1660, because she annoyed Charles II that much to get rid of her. He arranged for Randall to get his lands back. So it's quite unusual. It's relatively unusual to see a woman signing a document at this period. The next section. This is briefly relating to the big house, which in the Andrews case is Glenarm Castle, for the Fian Tempest part of the estate is Garan Tower. So you've got the family correspondence of the various members of the families, pedigrees, etc. The Antrim stuff, there isn't a large quantity of political papers. The stuff for relating to the second Earl is of some importance, obviously, because he played an important role in politics. And genealogies are there, quite a lot of genealogies of the family, including what I think is a very interesting one prepared in 1704 by a guy called Charles Linegar, one of the last Irish scholars and scribes who prepared a genealogy in Irish and English of the Antrims, which traces them right back to an Irish chieftain in prehistory. Quite an interesting political thing that they were aligning themselves with an Irish family rather than a Scottish one. And quite an interesting piece of late Irish script as well. It's not particularly well known. I think it should be better known. The political correspondence, such as with the family's political connections. Papers relating to the construction building of the big house is obviously a building like Glenarm Castle or Garan Tower is of interest in itself to architectural historians. So papers about the building of it, how it was built, how it was financed, all right, are there. It's not a great deal for Glenarm Castle. Some interesting stuff, but not a huge amount. There's a huge amount of papers for Garan Tower, building a Garan Tower. I think you could trace the laying of every brick because Francis Anne oversaw everything. So, there's a huge amount of material about it. Then household accounts, wages, books, and inventories for the house, for the castle. Just to see how the castle operated. In their heyday, these houses had very big staffs, 20 or 30 servants attached to it. They were a big institution in themselves, so the accounts and the wages books can be quite interesting. Militia, yeomanry, and muster records. Landlords usually had a military role. They usually had some sort of command in the local militia. There's a nice thing in the Antrim papers, which I keep talking about publishing and never do, which is a return of militia muskets, which was done in 1754 when the government suddenly wondered what happened to all the guns that they issued to the militia in 1745, and they asked the Earl of Antrim to account for the 600 muskets he got, and needless to say he couldn't find most of them. And there's an interesting note to saying that quite a few of them were thought to have been taken off over to America by various people who had left the estate to go to America. And then papers relating to the parish church, including tithe records, which you may also get there. Just by way of an example, again, political correspondence. This is something that the Record Office actually bought a few years ago when it turned up in an auction. It's a letter, autographed letter from Charles I to the Earl of Antrim. It's dated 1646, after Charles had surrendered to the parliamentarians, and it's ordering Antrim to lay down arms and to end his campaign. And basically telling him that he's on his own, he can shift for himself, actually, as well. So there's a nice group of letters which we bought from Charles I and from Henrietta Maria to the Earls of Antrim. Right, now we're coming down to the actual operation of the estate. Leases and lease books, we'll talk more about those later, but one of the important innovations or things that was introduced with the plantation and with the new way of running things in the 17th century was leases, written leases. The government was very keen that the landowners give leases to their tenants, because a lease is a two-way contract. The lease gives the tenant and the landlord responsibilities and rights, and it's important for keeping a check on the landlords, which is what the government wanted. So they were very keen to introduce leases, and we have a very good collection of leases. We'll be talking more about it in a minute in the Antrim estate. Leases and lease books were just obviously books which ledgers which actually list the leases. Estate correspondence, some very good stuff there. We're about to see it towards the end, some of Francis Anne's estate correspondence. For the other estate, it doesn't really take off till about 1860s, where you had a guy called Alex, Orson Andrew MacDonald took over the estate agency. He was then succeeded by his son, who was another MacDonald. They kept very, very good records of correspondence in and out, something which has never been looked at in any detail. There are literally hundreds of damp, what are called damp press letter books, showing the correspondence of the agents back and forward to various people. Huge amount of it. Estate maps, valuations and surveys. You'll see the importance of estate maps in a moment. I think they're one of the most important parts of the archive. You also have things like crop registers from periods when they actually were keeping a close eye on what was actually being grown on the estate. So you have some very, very interesting detailed registers of that sort of thing. And as I say, agent correspondence and reports, the agent corresponding with the landlord, reporting back to the landlord. Leases, as I say, that's one of the early leases. There's a very good collection of 17th century leases in the Antrim papers. I actually published a list of them a few years ago. There's about over 300 names from the 17th century in those leases. There's a particularly important group of leases all issued at the one time in 1637. Remember I said the second Earl had to raise money to go and spend in London. One of the way he did this was to release the whole estate, issue new leases to everybody. And a lot of those survive, and they're a very interesting set of leases, because what they did, not only did they give the names of the people they were holding the land, and this was the larger tenants, you know, the bigger people holding on to Antrim, but they set out a lot of conditions and what work these people were supposed to do. They were to build stone houses with slated roofs. They were to clear so many acres of land per year. They were to plant so many trees per year. All of that is put down in the lease. So they're an interesting thing to study in themselves. Another little study, which I was actually going to do for tonight, but didn't get the time to make a start on it, was just actually to look at the names. Very interesting collection of names, a mixture of Gaelic names, Highland names, Lowland Scots, and a few English. So you can actually see these names starting to appear up and down the glens. Nice little study for somebody to try and trace those surnames around. And the maps, a very good collection of the state maps. It's usually said that the land and estate maps are very important for the pre-ordnance survey period. When you had no government mapping, this is the only detailed mapping going on, is the mapping done by the landlords. Now, that's true, but I also will argue that they remain important after ordnance survey, because they are working often at a higher scale than the ordnance survey, and they're showing all sorts of detail which the OS don't show. Particularly, they're showing information about ownership. This is obviously Deer Park Farms, not too far from here, but it's showing the boundaries of the various plots. The names of the various tenants are put on this. There's a lot of detail on that. It's a larger scale. Some of them are larger than the standard OS 6-inch mapping. After the OS maps became available, they did use the OS maps, and the fact that they would often copy and scale up from OS maps. But there's a lot more detail on the landed estate maps, which I really think that are worth a study. They're often also quite attractive things as well. That's a very nice, though it's a working document, it's obviously a very nice map. You get these beautifully drawn maps, and then somebody in the estate office has scribbled all over them, because as far as the estate office is concerned, they were just a working document. So you drew lines on them, and somebody scribbled little notes all over this. And of course, the little notes are also of extreme importance as well. So when we're doing the research. Another types of documents. Records of land farmed directly by the landlord. As well as leasing land, the Antrims generally had some part of the land only under their own control, which they farmed directly. The area, obviously the home farm around Glenarm Castle. So there's quite a lot of farm accounts and wages books, late 19th century, market garden account, herd books and stud books for their own farming, which gives you some idea of how a sort of a largish farm would actually operate at this period. Don't see much more about those. Estate businesses, I said the estate is a business. The main business it's in is leasing land, but it got involved in other things as well. They owned and developed a lot of the harbours up and down the coast. They got involved in the building of railways, open line works. There was a sawmills in Glenarm, the line works down there. Papers for all those enterprises are in the estate papers. Mines and mineral rights, very important to say in the 19th century. I published a few years ago an account of one of the smaller mines that was going on in the Glens area. There's a lot of those small lignite mines up and down the place. An interesting subject that could be studied further. even hotels, you know, the Ballygally Castle Hotel was owned by the Earl of Antrim at one stage. And the electricity supply in Glenarm, I'm nearly right in saying, was a company set up by the Earl of Antrim before it was taken over by the larger concern. So they're involved in all sorts of things in the area, all sorts of businesses, and that continues, as I say, into the 20th century. And just by way of an example, I, as I said, did that paper on a small lignite mine up at Killymuris. So you get things like that. That's just rather crude, but in its own way interesting diagram of the mine, showing the various adits going into the mine and where the coal seam was. You have to take my word that it's interesting, but it is interesting if you're in the mines. Records relating to landlord's rights is a fairly broad category. Again, it's another way of extracting money out of the estate. Obviously, Tubri, the bogs and the turf cutting rights are a big thing. Quite a lot of papers on turf, maps of turf bogs, turf books, an area of great contention about who had the right to take turf out of a bog. The early leases quite often give specific rights to a lessee to take so much turf out of a nearby bog. Fishing and hunting rights. The salmon fisheries around the Antrim coast were extremely important to the Antrims, quite lucrative. A lot of papers on those and the renting out of those, commercialisation of those. Hunting rights, particularly in the later years when the landlords became very concerned to retain the right to hunt over their land, particularly for Frances Anne, who was quite keen to acquire even further hunting rights over lands. You usually find in the leases, interestingly enough, that the landlord reserves the right to hunt over the land. It's not passed over with the lease to the tenant. The landlord has the right to do the actual hunting. Mills and milling rights. A lot of the leases will stipulate that the corn grown on the particular farm has to be taken to a particular mill and ground in that mill. And that's an important right because obviously they then leased out the mills, and it was important that the mills had that monopoly, that the farmers had to go to a particular mill. So that's quite an important and profitable right. And market rights as well. They owned the market rights in Larne and Portrush and Ballymoney, and probably Ballycastle at one stage. So they were able to get a fee from anybody selling things in the market. And that was quite a profitable little thing as well. Now, documents concerning services provided by the landlord, which is probably, you may feel, a rather strange title, but it was a two-way operation. The landlord was supposed to do things for the tenants. There was a social contract here, as they call it. The landlord was supposed to look after people. So there's various services provided by the landlord. One of them was schools. Most of the schools in the area, the landlord was involved in setting them up. He usually gave the land for free. He often put money to actually build the school or to employ the teachers. The agent for the estate usually acted as manager of the school and looked after the business affairs. There's a very, very good set calendar correspondence for the Glenarm schools, which was done a few years ago, which gives you a very interesting day-by-day account of what life was like in the local schools. During times of famine, which we'll see more about that later, they were involved in setting up things like soup kitchens and helping people who were destitute. They set up often, Frances Anne, again, was very into this, setting up savings banks and province societies for the tenants, telling them if they paid in whatever it was, so many pence per week, she would add some money in. And usually conditions about what they could do with the money, of course. I'm going to do that. Clothing societies were another thing. They paid out a few pence per week and were able to buy blankets or clothes at a cut price rate. Frances Anne was around that sort of thing. The last one there is manorial courts. Again, I wrote this up a few years ago. The Antrim manorial courts are a very interesting institution. By the terms of original charters, the big landlords like the Antrims had the right to run their own courts, which weren't crown courts. By the middle of the 18th century, they primarily became concerned with what we now call a small debts court, of settling sort of minor disputes between local people, usually for the recovery of a debt. So they provided a very interesting service. They were much cheaper and easier to operate than the crown courts, and they were actually quite popular with the local people, who would rather go to manorial court, which was more informal, than go to a crown court. They also had a role in local government in the Glenarm area, but you have to read the article I did if you want to know more about that. That's the Manor Courthouse in Ballymoney, the market house which the Antrims paid for the construction of, at least part of, which is still there. It's now the Masonic Hall in Ballymoney. Right, we're now going on to a case study. I can find my notes on it. Cúna Gobal, did I get that right? Yes, good. I was worried about the pronunciation of that. It's a clachan, as you probably all know, up to the north there. The townland runs from the bottom here, near the road of that bridge, up nearly to the top of the mountain, along the lines of that road, on the other side of that road. There's still a settlement there, I think. I think there still is a few houses there, which are still occupied. It's quite an interesting little study. When I was talking to somebody in the record office about this the other day, I said I had it all worked out. Since then, I've learned to my cost I didn't have it all worked out, so I'm probably more confused now than when I started the study. However, as I thought to myself, it's not my job to sort this out, it's your job to sort this out. I'm going to present you with some information this evening about this clachan and see if you can sort out what was going on, because I'm not sure that I can. First of all, do this case study. I want to see what information would be available about this townland, and particularly about the clachan. I didn't look at all the available information because there wasn't time. I concentrated on two things, maps and surveys in the estate archive and leases, and I looked at what they could tell us about it. The first map that shows the area is 1734. A survey was done by a guy called Archibald Stewart in 1734, and he did hold estate. I haven't sort of scanned it or put it up there because it doesn't actually show you very much. It doesn't show you anything actually in the area. It was mainly concerned with showing the boundaries of the townland. And as we'll see later, the whole townland was leased out on a lump by the Antrim, so they weren't really interested in what was going on inside it. What is interesting, and it's something I don't want to go into now, is that the boundaries of the townland are different from the current ones, and the names of the townlands adjoining Cúna Gobal are different from the names that they're there now. So there's another interesting field of endeavour for somebody who's looking at the changes in townland names. There's a lot of evidence for that in the estate papers. But the next map I came across was one of 1782 by a surveyor called John O'Hara. I had to put this sideways. I'll show you more detailed one in a minute. But that is the townland, more or less as we know it now. It shows the clachan. I'll show you in that more detail later. It divides it up roughly into the arable and pasture land and the grazing land. That's the boundary of the arable and pasture. The rest of it is mountain and heathland. There's no road going through the townland as there is now. We'll see that coming in later. So there's not a lot there at that time, except with the clachan's there. That's a more detailed one. It shows seven buildings. Now, I don't know whether that can be taken literally or that was just how many he actually fitted in. Seven buildings surrounded by a belt of trees on three sides. So that's 1782. Clachan is definitely there and of some size. Exactly what size, we don't know, but some size. But no sign of any road connecting it to the main county road at this period. With this map, there is some sort of text which I didn't scan in, which gives you the basic details. And according to it, there are 82 acres of arable and pasture land and 394 acres of mountain covered with heath. Now, that's plantation acres, which are larger than statute acres. So a fairly small proportion of the townland is arable. The rest of it is mountain land. The next thing we come to is another survey. This is actually a written survey rather than a mapping survey, which was done about 1812, a survey of the whole estate. And I'll just read you, if I can find the papers, what this guy had to say. I'll have to move over here to read this. About the townland in 1812. Now, he refers back to that 1782 survey, which we saw earlier. He says, a part of this quarter land has since the survey of O'Hara, that's the map we saw earlier there, been reclaimed from a rough state of mountain pasture to tillage. And the improvement is great when it's considered that it has been done without manure or any other sort of... without any other sort of help and under a course of incessant cropping. In other words, they didn't let the land fallow without using manure. They just converted it into arable land. And he does mention that throughout this townland, you get limestone very close to the surface, which he thinks would add to the fertility of the area. And as well as that sort of comment about this coming in, he does give us some more statistics. And he says, and this is now using statute acres, the arable land is 116 acres, the reclaimed mountain land 110 acres, and the remaining brown mountain, as he calls it in bog, 557. So you're getting evidence there of the increasing population pressure in Ireland, and particularly in the north of Antrim, that they're having to bring this marginal land under cultivation. So the area of cultivated land is spreading up the mountain, and you see that very clearly there. And it's being done, as he says, without the help of anything like lime or any other fertilisers. It's just being done by just taking the land under the plough. So that's quite a telling little point about population pressure. The next thing we found is an even more interesting map dating from 1849. Now, there's quite a lot in this map here. I'll be showing you more detailed accounts of it in a minute. First thing I'll mention, there's now a road going up through the Clachan, right the way through the middle of the townland, and going right the way up, you can't see it there, to a small quarry up the mountain. And down from the quarry, about here, there's a lime kiln. So they were quarrying up there, and they were burning lime for fertiliser. No clues about when the road was made, but obviously somewhere between 1782 and 1849. You can also see the field system spreading right the way up the townland. It's getting very, very far up the mountain now. Again, the intense population pressure. What was going on in those? Right, Mission Road. That's a close-up of the actual Clachan part of the map, showing a lot of buildings there now. And the Ordnance Survey memoir, written about 1837, this period, talks of a large group of cabins here. They don't call it the village, and you know, they actually say there are no villages in the whole parish, but this is the largest group of cabins. So they're not calling it a village. So basically, there's no public buildings, presumably, and there's no real structure to it, if this is to be believed. I haven't actually looked at the Ordnance Survey, I have to compare it, but if that's accurate, I mean, it doesn't appear to be much structure to the place. It's just a group of buildings in the middle of there. But you know, it does show a lot of buildings or cabins in that area. Now, probably the most interesting thing about this was the field structure. Coming back out again a bit. These very narrow strips in the arable land here. These are very narrow strips, and they're all numbered. As we'll see, these are all being leased individually. So I think this is a fairly clear case of Rundale. This is like something that you see in a textbook to illustrate Rundale. You know, very narrow strip farms. So what's going on here? How's the estate being let out, and how's it been managed? So we're going to sort of jump backwards, as it were, and look at the evidence from the leases. There's a nice group of leases for this townland in the Antrim records, and that's, you know, part of the page was list them. The earliest lease for the townland itself is 1710. And it's being leased to a member of the MacDonald family, John MacDonald. There were various branches of the MacDonalds living in this area, as you probably know, in the north. And a lot of them held lands under the Earl of Antrim's. I presume they're related to the Antrim's. You might be able to trace them through. But it's a John MacDonald holding the whole townland at this stage. He's a John MacDonald Esquire, so he's a fairly prominent character. He's leasing the whole townland. So that's 1710. 1742, it's again another, it's Randall MacDonald, again holding the whole townland straight from the family. He renews it again in 1746. So at that stage, the whole townland has been leased by the Antrims as a unit, so they weren't involved in, you know, how it was being farmed or whatever. 1781, it obviously comes back into the hands of the family. We don't know why, but it's no longer being leased in a lump. and they're leasing it in groups, in quarters. They split it up into quarters. It says here, now we have three leases, each for one quarter, so I'm assuming that there's a missing lease somewhere. They're given to groups of people. Archibald Black, Dennis O'Hara and John Robison are one group. William O'Shale and Duncan Dara are another group. And the third group is more of the Daras, I think. More of the Duncans. Robert Duncan, John Duncan, Charles Duncan and John Duncan Jr. So they all had a section of the townland. But then again, in 1821, there's another change and there's another group of leases, and there's an even larger group here of, there's now, well, there remains in the group, I think it's seven leases, which mention a total of 12 people. Again, I think there's evidence there's actually some missing and there's more of that. It's been divided up into much smaller parcels. Again, you have groups of people taking these leases. First one here is Alexander Black, Dennis Black, Archibald McLaughlin, James O'Shale and James McCarry, all together leasing something which amounts to 29 acres. And how they're doing it is interesting, because what they're leasing is, and I quote here, being the 1/4 part of field number 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 26, 5. Those are the numbers on that map. And without going into details, they are scattered all over the arable bit of the farm. So they're leasing bits of fields all over the townland. And they are also, it also mentions they have got a proportion of the grazing on the mountain in proportion to how much land they're holding. And how they work that out, I do not know. But so that's how it's been done. You have all these tenants in groups leasing fields all over the townland. So again, a fairly clear case of Rundale. Right, so what happens next? The next document, which we find, is, well, that's just one of the leases, just to show you that's one of the earlier 1782 leases. Point I wanted to make there, actually, as well, all these leases, is the majority of the people signing them were marksmen. They're making their mark, they couldn't actually sign their name. So an interesting point to bear in mind, they couldn't actually read these documents. And that may be relevant later. The next group of papers we find is a bunch of decrees for non-payment of rent in 1847, which covers the whole townland. These all tell more or less the same story. They hadn't paid their rent at this stage for 2.5 years in most cases. They'd fallen into arrears. Very hard times, the 1840s, everywhere in Ireland, and the Glen's no exception. So they were faced with this ejectment, which is a court order telling them to hand their possession of the land and their houses back to the landlord. Now, it's quite a drastic step. I know there's a whole sort of history and mythology about landlord-tenant relations and ejectments. It's a very emotional subject. There wasn't that many evictions carried out, particularly in Antrim. It was a serious step to evict a tenant. It's a very serious step to try and clear a whole townland, and particularly a townland up a mountain somewhere north Antrim. It's one thing clearing them out, who you're going to get to replace them. So the landlord would not necessarily be in a hurry to actually do this. However, it gave him a lever, it gave him a tool. And what did he do with it? Well, the next group of documents is this group of agreements, which each of these groups of tenants signed. And what the agreements set out, I'll just go through it briefly. It says, whereas these people, and this is Daniel Scally, Innes McMullen, John Duncan and Mary White, who together held land in the townland, and they admit that they're in arrears. They can't, as well as the arrears, there's all the court fees which have now built up, which they're liable for, so they're even further in debt at this stage. And the Earl of Antrim has brought an ejectment, so he has the right to throw them out. However, this agreement is that, in consideration of the Earl of Antrim not disposing them of their property and giving them new farms, I'll just get the quiet text here. And consideration of said redividing the whole of the lands in Colnagobble in said country in order to make square and compact farms. So what he's going to do is not throw them out. He's going to give them a new lease with a square and compact farm, if they agree. But what they have to do is surrender their lease to him and all their rights to him. And in exchange, he's going to give them a new lease, he says, with a nice little compact farm. However, he also says, provided, however, and it's expressly agreed that by these said people, that if they can't pay the arrears that they owe him off, they don't get a new lease and they become tenants at will. That is to say, they're still there, they're still farming the land, but they don't have a lease. So that's the agreement they all sign, or they all put their X on, as it happens. And that is what happens. Now, that seemed, at this stage it all seemed quite simple, you know, he divided it all, the town is now divided up into square compact farms, isn't it? Well, the evidence of the Griffiths valuation says otherwise. Griffiths valuation 1764, not a single farm marked out, the whole townland is held under one plot. And according to the printed Griffiths, all of the townland is held jointly by tenants leasing from the Earl of Antrim, but they're not divided up, it does not show individual farms. What happened? I think what happened is these people couldn't pay off the debts. They couldn't raise that money to pay him the lump sum he wanted. So the Earl says, right, you'll make the square. I suspect he said you'll have the square compact farms. We'll do that bit of it. But you're not going to have a lease. You're going to be tenants at will. That is to say, you have no real rights on the land. And we'll see how things go from there. And I can find my papers here. Visiting your website and getting information from there. Sorry about that. Didn't know I was going to be wired for sound tonight. What happens when you look at the population figures, and I forgot to bring the printout with me, which has them on it, between 1841 and 1851 you have a slight fall in population. Between 1851 and 1816 you have a major fall. Population in that townland falls by a third or more. Now obviously this is post-famine Ireland, you're expecting population first, but I suspect what happened is that after 1747, or it's after 1849 when all this is agreed, after that he is able to get rid of the tenants quite easily and you have a major clear out. And he reduces the amount of people holding land. Because of tenants and will, they don't really have any comeback. So as I say, one by one, they were probably got rid of, reducing the number of tenants on the land to one where it could be sustained. Now, the landlord lost out in that he lost all his arrears of rent. But he does get a smaller group of people paying regularly, and he does get square compact farms out of it. I think that's what's happened. There are further areas of investigation possible. I haven't looked through all of the rentals and rent books for the estate to see if the people are paying rents regularly for this townland. There may be some evidence of that. I didn't look through the Griffiths. I looked at the Griffiths map and I looked at the Griffiths revision map, neither of which show any divisions or boundaries. I didn't look through the revision book to see how they recorded the holdings in Griffiths after Griffiths. It'd be interesting to see how that pans out, how the area is being valued. And I didn't look at what could be quite interesting, which is the papers of land registry, which would show what happened when the estate or the townland was sold off to its tenants. Those might give some clues about how the land was divided. You are showing field boundaries in this map, and obviously they are different, much larger than those field boundaries on McGee's map, although you know, still quite small fields. This townland just below it, incidentally, is divided up neatly into compact farms, all running down to the road, having access to the road. Textbook case of how it should be done. But I say, what happens at Coonagobble? It's over to you to work out exactly how they divided up that townland and exactly how it worked out in practice. But it is an example of how a landlord dealt with a particular problem. I would say, I think pre-famine you have to say that townland was overcrowded. There were too many people there. They couldn't make a living, they couldn't pay the rents. You needed to get rid of some of them. That's how the landlord dealt with it. Eviction notices, but not to evict them, but to force them into agreeing to another way of holding the land. So as I say, it's now over to whoever wants to research to take it further and see if I'm right about that. Okay. Now, I'm going to talk briefly at this stage. That was sort of a case study. I was going to do another case study, but on Frances Anne. But Frances Anne was a bit of a case in herself. So I shall talk briefly about Frances Anne and give you some flavour of what she was at. This is an example of using the estate records to get a flavour of landlord-tenant relations and just basically how everyday life was going on and how people cope with each other. Sorry about this, that many pieces of paper here, I've lost track of them. Frances Anne. Right, this was the daughter of Anne Catherine, who married Charles Stuart, 3rd Marquess of London, famous military man, who had a distinguished military career, fought with Wellington in both senses, as I say, he fought alongside of him and he fell out with him all the time. He was a man who hated foreigners and had no manners, so after the war he went into diplomatic service, where he rose to prominent heights, became ambassador to various places and nearly started a couple of small wars, ably assisted by Frances Anne, all the stages, very interesting character, both of them were. They were also extremely rich. Frances Anne inherited from her daddy the Harry Vane Tempest, one of the largest coal fields in England, when they eventually worked out how to get the coal out of it. And they developed that coal field, and Londonderry coal fields in Durham became a very, very important coal field, and they produced an awful lot of money for the family and made the Londonderrys one of the major political families in the UK, quite major figures. So she had that property. Charlie Stuart wasn't exactly penniless. The Londonderrys had a large estate round North Antrim, around Mount Stuart, plus a lot of land in Derry. So they weren't short of a bob or two. The Antrim estate, the bit of the MacDonald estate she inherited, wasn't a very large proportion of their overall holdings. However, you get the sense that it was extremely important to her. It was hers, not his, it was hers. It was her personal little plaything. And she got the income from the estate and went directly to her. Now it was the 1830s before the whole rigmarole was settled really, and the division of the estate was made and settled. But after that, Frances Anne took a very close interest in what would happen on in the estate. She demanded reports and letters from her agents. She made the agents' life a misery, in fact, for most of her life. She invested a lot of money in the estate, it must be said, and I would suggest if you did a cost-benefit analysis, if you were that boring, of the estate, you would find that she put more into it than she got out. Really, because she invested a lot of money, and we're sitting in the result of her investment here tonight. You know, part of it in the village of Carnlough, the harbour, the lime works, this hotel, whatever. You know, she did put money into the estate. She also took the money out of the estate. She was very keen about getting her rents out because that went to buy her dresses, and she had an awful lot of dresses. So she runs the estate, although Charles does the dirty work. If you have a question of sacking anybody or affecting anybody, it's always Charles who does it. And as I say, she demands reports and accounts back and forward from anybody. She was driven by a desire, you know, to improve the estate. She was also driven by her rivalry with the other branch of the family, with the Earls of Antrim. Part of the estate agents' work was to report what was going on in Glenarm Castle. And if anything was built in Glenarm, if they got a police station or a post office in Glenarm, it had to be a police station or a post office built in Carnlough. You know, she was that was another thing which was really driving her. Now, the papers and correspondence is, I think, fairly well known. To some of you, it's been published over the years. It is quite a rich source. I'm going to briefly go through a few things here, just to give you an idea of what you could do and what use could be made of it. Sorry if any of you have heard some of this before. Again, I confine myself mainly to these reports which were done. She was getting annual reports from her agent, which is something I haven't seen in any other estate. As well as sort of correspondence back and forth, the agent doing an annual report like all government departments do these days. You know, the difference between those and the government department's report was somebody was actually reading these reports. Frances Anne was annotating them in the margins, sending them back sometimes. Thankfully, nobody does that with the reports I do in work. So one of the earliest reports, because they had these estates in County Down, they were able to draw on the people who ran those estates to come up and look at it. And there's an interesting connection between Cumber and Carnlough, because a lot of Cumber people were brought up here to comment on things, because that was, you know, the centre of the Stuart estate. And John Andrews, who's an important figure in the history of Cumber, was actually sent up in 1837 to look at the estate and the comment on it. And he makes some interesting general comments about the estate. The condition of the tenantry is such as might be expected under the circumstances, which is not a very helpful remark, but they appear to be an orderly, well-affected race and generally satisfied with their lot, but from attachment to old and deteriorating system of agriculture, little advanced in the path of improvement, which in highly scientifically cultivated districts has led to the enjoyment and abundance of prosperity. And that's a point you will see me made over and over again over the next few years. The tenants are very old-fashioned in their agricultural methods. But he said, you know, there are some signs of improvement, and he analyses the two main problems. Specific causes are chiefly to be found in the old Irish system of allotment called Rundale, under which land has been held promiscuously in mixed and scattered patches, effectively preventing enclosure and improvement. And the other thing he notices, the inaccessible position of many of the tracts for the want of roads. Now, the former, that's the problem with Rundale, has been steadily and judiciously obliterated in every case where the expiration of leases has permitted it. In other words, where leases were falling in, tenants were being forced to give up Rundale. And he also goes on to recommend a lot of road building, including the building the road on the south side of Glencloy, which was built over the next few years, and he recommends that the landlord put a lot of the money into building those roads. John Langtry, on his first report, the report is 1844, gives some interesting background to the estate. Then, at this stage, it was about 10,000 acres. 5,000 of the acres were mountain, and a few hundred were turf and bog, so not a great deal of arable land in the estate. And he says, analysis showing a large portion of the estate is a state of imperfect cultivation, subject to very low comparative rental, and a consequence, much of the value will be enhanced by better systems of agriculture. So again, fighting away at this, they need to improve the agriculture to actually get more money out of the estate. The tenantry, he says, are docile and peaceable. Their desires are moderate and their wants few. Accustomed to sheep upon their hills, they spin their own wool and weave frieze coats and dugget for their ordinary wear. They have very humble ideas of domestic comfort and are negligent in many matters which, in a more advanced stage, would be considered essential. This guy's from Cumber, by the way, so don't take us too seriously. They are in general poor, yet it is gratifying to them, as I have sustained from many inquiries, that they are gradually getting better in their circumstances. And there is good reason to hope that the extension, that beneficial system, which was, and he goes on to talk about how wonderful the states in Cumber are, that the finding might sort of reach those states. But passing over that, he goes into some details, and I'll read a bit about Glencloy. Glencloy district, containing with 3,000 acres, will hereafter become one of the first proportions of the estate. Commencing with Stony Hill at Carnlough Bay, it stretches up a beautiful valley to the crest of hills on each side. If the new road through Bally Valley, about which I wrote your lordship, be made to the shore, the tenants will be much benefited, and I have no doubt they will spiritually improve their holdings. And there's a note from her ladyship saying, new road must be done. There's a cottage of Wright, which was accidentally burned this spring, and in which the proprietor came to an untimely end. Having been enabled by the bounty of your lordship and your ladyship to rebuild this, it now stands a nice little model for the county, for the country. And he talks about 40 acres of waste land which he had brought back into cultivation and investing £20 in it. And can I have the £20 back, please? Tenants of Acklam and Gorton, there's clackens up there, I know, have long been holding at will and applied for leases. I ordered the new survey of their lands and increased the rental on those denominations, but to what extent I cannot say. Getting a lease is a two-edged sword. Getting a lease gives you security, but it gives them the landlord a chance to put the rent up. So there's a lot of tenants at wills out there looking for leases. And he talks about, although it's nothing to do with the Clackens, but Carnlough, the only village in the estate, is in this district. And if your lordship will give building leases here, as in Newton Arch, of 3 lives renewable for 31 or 61 years, I could get very much improved and make it an acquisition to the neighbourhood and an ornament to the property. And your ladyship agrees to give leases. The beautiful line of coast road has been completed between this and Cushion Dahl. At Garn Point, the tenants are desiring erecting a schoolhouse upon it, which could be ornamental and useful. Ladyship says they very much approve of this. And I think she actually put some of the money up for the schoolhouse there. Glenraffle district, a level tract 15 miles from Glenarm, and as such, natural facilities were becoming a nice agricultural field that I have great hopes of becoming so in no distant period. Now, an interesting little study here. A case occurred, which occasioned me some uneasiness. One of the tenants, who had been allowed to fall into 3 years arrears on a farm of 36 acres, made off with his entire crop and stock last season, just after my appointment. I went at once to the place and succeeded in getting from him the possession of the house, but the house was a complete wreck. I had to expend money upon it before I could advertise it, and when I did, on two occasions without effect, I ascertained that this was principally occasioned by the influence of the late occupier, who hoped to be allowed to return at half rent, and I perceived that the tenants generally were not displeased to see me in difficulty, which I was obliged to yield to. They might have renewed to serve their own purpose occasion. Under these circumstances, I went to Newton Arge, and after much canvassing, succeeded in finding a tenant very much to my own mind, to whom, having made liberal advances from my own resource to enable her, interestingly, to crop and stock land, I have now the satisfaction of seeing luxuriant crops growing where an indolent sloven lived in beggary, and a spirited example of turnip husbandry to the neighbourhood. He was very into turnips. And further received all the arrears which were never allowed to accrue, which the formal occupants would never have been able to collect. So that was one way of dealing with problems, bringing in a new tenant from outside who had different ideas about how to manage the farm and what crops to grow. Turnips was a big obsession of Langtree's. He wanted to introduce the growing of turnips as an alternative to potatoes. So that's some of the ways. He talks generally about how he's going to run the estate. In my efforts to get the rents in, I have so far availed myself rather of the moral means of persuasion, threatening and advice rather than the law. I have not yet paid a shilling to an attorney, which her ladyship says is very satisfactory. In these extreme cases where a change was indispensable, I effected my object in peace and procured assistance from two of the outgoing tenants. I do not indeed hope to always so successful. I shall always be my ambition to strive. So, you know, he was taking what he considered to be a moderate count, not being confrontational, but making sure that he got his money in. Now, as you probably know, Langtree came to grief a few years later in the famine, where he gave a lot of the tenants discounts, or allowed them off their arrears of rent to an extent which annoyed her ladyship, and she sacked him when it came to a bad end. But he was trying at that stage to balance the two out, you know, to be reasonable with the tenants and to make sure that she got her money in. Now just a few more things in sort of extracts from various bits of report. Post-famine in 1840, well, not post-famine, but, you know, after the famine starts coming in 1848, when you're starting to see hardship, he mentions that people are having to leave the estate, and he talks about one occasion when many farmers from Ballymacaldrick, which is over towards Dunkloy direction, been forced to leave the state and emigrated, and they went on a ship called the Exmouth, which ran the storm and actually ran aground off the Scottish coast. Went to the bottom within grasp of land and left not one passenger of hundreds to tell the tale. Others, chiefly from Drumcann, after landing safely in America, were seized with fever which raged there in an unexpected manner and perished ere they found a home. So, you know, it's fairly serious stuff about, you know, people being driven off the land. But he says something of the salt up. Generally speaking, these thinnings were for good. They enlarged some farms in the hands of better labourers than the immigrants had been, and if many more should go away, of which there is a prospect, it would be all the better for the estate, for without the potato crop it is quite impossible for small farmers to live and pay rent, especially on poor soils. So that was the pragmatic approach. You know, the place was overcrowded, and there was too many people trying to get a living off the land, and that was the bottom line. But now, he did leave a very moving account of the famine in and around the area, which I published a couple of years ago, extracting the famine in Glencloy and the Glen, so I'll not go into it in any detail. But he did, you know, his wife went round a lot of the houses and farms in the area and looked at what was happening to people and reported back to her ladyship, who did help up to a point. She gave food aid, she gave blankets and the siege. You can debate at great length whether she did enough, whether the landlords did enough at this period, considering what was going on. But they were aware of what was going on, and they did give some help. One other document, as well as these sort of reports, and Frances Anne had a rather modern fixation with consultants, and she kept bringing these people in to report on the estate. There's a guy called James Douglas who described himself as an agriculturalist who went round every single farm in the estate in 1856. Now, his reports, I don't think I've ever been really studied in any detail. Certainly I haven't, but this is Agalum, basically, where there's another Clacken. Just to go briefly over the sort of information and notes which you're getting. First Farm, Randall William McFall Sr. The farm is very well cultivated and bearing excellent crops. No draining required in the farm. General appearance good, with a clean, well-kept dwelling house. So he gets good marks. He didn't approve of all of them. On rental, James McKerney, this farm is only middling, but situated on inferior crops. No improvements required. So he goes round each one like that and gives. So that's a very interesting source, which I say has never been really worked at. You're getting a brief account of each one. And he talks about the whole townland in general. Some of the tenants on the townland are very industrious and improving. Others of them appear to be discontented, indolent, and altogether an unimproving class of tenant. Alterations here, as soon as opportunity might occur, might be desirable. The response, interestingly enough, and I'm not sure whether it's the response from the agent or from the landlord, I think this is the agent reporting this. I know no other method to pursue unless ejecting, which I am adverse doing, as they all hitherto have paid annually a year's rent. So he said we're getting money out of them, so let's be careful here, let's not rush in. And of all principally being reared on their holdings. So an interesting question, if the agriculturalist says, you think about clearing these people out, the agent saying in this case, no, hold on, these people lived here all their lives, and to pay their rent, let's not get overexcited here about clearing them out and bringing new people in. So that's just another example of, you know, how the estate was being managed. I think I will close on that. I just give you a rough idea of the sort of depth and detail which you can get. I will make one final point about this. One is a word of warning. It's a very, very big archive, the Antrim Estate Archive, and some of the other ones are. It doesn't have everything in it. It's not consistent across all the townlands. You know, what townlands do you have maps like that for? Well, everyone except the one you're looking for was probably the answer. You're not necessarily going to get all the things I mentioned tonight for the area you're looking at, but however, there's a lot of stuff there. The Antrim Estate Archive has been used quite extensively. Partly down to me tramping around going on about it at great length and boring everybody in Prony about it. Some of the other archives have been used. A lot of the archives in Prony Estate Archives have never been used and never been opened since the day they're put in the stores. There's a huge amount of material out there in which to do local history, so I would encourage you to go on and get into it and find that out. And it is really local people. Me from outside, like your man from Cumber, I can't come in here and, you know, pass judgments and work out always what's going on. It takes local eyes and local knowledge, so I would encourage you to move on with this through the Clackens Project and carry on this research. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Thank you very much indeed, Ian. I hope you won't mind if I asked if there's any questions. Does anyone have any questions or comments for Ian after a very long and interesting lecture? I'm not complaining, by the way.
The many records of the smaller landlords, they got the Antrim land after broken up.
There's a few of them, yes. I mentioned a relatively small landlord, John Higginson, who had land around Knappen, for instance. That's the family that produced Morrow and Ale Portress. That's that one I happen to know about because I catalogued it. So there was a nice small estate archive there. There's a lot of stuff for the Boyds and the McCartneys. Yes, the smaller ones over there, the O'Hara's is another one. They are there, yes. Sometimes they take a wee bit of looking. I should have mentioned earlier, a lot of the estate papers survive in solicitors' collections, so you have to go through the papers of a lot of the solicitors, and you find a lot of the information there. So the smaller ones, it does a wee bit of searching. We did do a guide a few years ago to Landed Estate Records in Prony, which does list all the estates in the county. So you should see what we hold for each estate.
Have you anything on Richardson, if you remember?
Not in County Antrim. There's Richardson's of Bessbrook. There's that family I taken, huh?
The Cushion Door.
Couldn't say off the top of my head. Could be, but it doesn't ring any bells, I'm afraid. Anyone else? Yes, it's a short answer. Glenarif, you get a very complicated situation. There's what's called the Hollow Blade Lands there. And I won't go into that because we all want to get home tonight. But yes, certainly they were holding up there. They were certainly had the mineral rights up there, or thought they had, and they got in the big row when the mining started up there. But yes, they certainly had interests up there, and they certainly had land up there at that stage. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I always had the view that the landlords lost control of the lands for a while, and therefore that's why Brumdale came about. But mm-hmm. the fact, what's interesting there, to me anyway, mm-hmm. is the fact that he is actually leasing these mm-hmm. plots of land which are all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's not sort of leasing a big block and allowing the tenants to do that themselves. So he, in fact, is perpetuating the scheme
yeah.
at that stage. And then later on, of course, he wants to.
Yeah. Well, he probably just needed the money. 1821, they were pretty short of money. And he probably thought, you know, life's too short to go in here and try to sort these people out, if that's what they want to do, as long as I get my rent out of them. Now, obviously, when they got into problems in the 1840s, you know, he wasn't getting any money in because nobody was paying him anything. And he said, at this stage, right, we'll have to do something about this. We'll have to reorganise. Then, but you know, it's a balance between the landlord saying, you know, this is how we should be running it, this is the most efficient way of doing it, and I'm saying, you know, I need some money out of these people. And that was a particularly difficult time for the Antrim family, you know, between the death of the sixth Earl in 1791 until the whole estate was settled. Really, it didn't happen until the 1830s, 1840s. You did get a period when it's very confused, and the main interest concern at that stage would be to get as much money as possible out of the estate.
Colonel Gilbert, you mentioned a number of names,
mm-hmm.
and the strange thing is a number of those names are owners of big farms in Kerry parties.
Right.
I'll not name them because mm-hmm. assassinated and they were brought home.
Yeah.
But I just interested in the names here.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. The ones that stayed and remained, I think, would have been in a stronger position. You know, I think you have to be objective and say that, you know, the landlords and the agents were right about that. There were just too many people in some of these areas who couldn't be supported, so you had to do something. You had to leave, and unfortunately, it took a famine to do it in a lot of the cases. But you know, there was that. But you know, the ones that stayed, you know, could have benefited. The other interesting thing about those names is, it would be nice if you could try and work out what the relationships are. Are there marriage relationships here? You know, why are these groups of people coming together? Is it just an arbitrary thing? Because they couldn't afford to take a lease out on their own. I should say the other disadvantage of tenant for a lease is he had to pay some money up. You know, there's fees and whatever connected with the lease, which the tenant had to pay. So you needed a wee bit of capital to get a lease. But if there are parish records for the parish, I don't know if they are, it would be nice to take those group of people and see if you can look at the family, how they interrelate to each other. I mean, there's a lot of questions there. I mean, as I said, I started off quite confident. Now I feel I don't know anything about the area, but you know, how the heck this operated under the Rumdale with all these people, you know, holding the same bits of land. You know, did they work things together? Were they working cooperatively? They were working cooperatively to a certain extent, because the Griffiths, Print of Griffiths, shows you, for instance, that there was a herd living up the mountain, and he was leasing from his hut from two or three of the larger tenants, so they were collectively leasing out the hut to this herd, and I suspect he was working for all of the tenants in the townland. So there is some evidence of collective farming and the community working together there.
If you take other landlords like Montgomery's,
mm-hmm.
or the Carkis up here,
mm-hmm.
or the McNaughton's, for instance, what stage? Presumably all that land originally was owned by the
mm-hmm.
Africans.
What
yeah. stage, and how did
they make it? It varies. It started, the whole thing started with those 1637 leases. A lot of fee farms there, a lot of the store goes go out of the, that's when the Agnews, for instance, they get their land out at 1637. For the other ones, it comes later on during the 18th century when the state's in a minority. McCartney moved up there about 1710. He was a Belfast merchant, for instance, and he bought into the land at that stage. So it was over a period of years. The Boyds, it was 1735, 1736 when the Boyds got Ballycastle. So it's over a long period that they're buying out the land from the Antrims, taking these fee farms. So in individual estates, it will vary a lot.